This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Our guest today, author Jefferson Morley, began writing about James Angleton of the CIA in 2015. Angleton, you should know, had a surprisingly large role to play in many secret actions that took place during the Cold War, which resonates still. From its earliest days, the Central Intelligence Agency was a powerful force directing clandestine operations around the world. James Angleton would, from 1947 till his forced retirement in 1974, wield enormous influence within the agency. Given that Angleton operated in a world of tightly held secrets, any attempted biography will have more than the usual number of problems accessing data. Luckily for all of us, Jefferson Morley applied his skills as an investigative journalist to the task, using archival material, released secret documents, and interviews with those who knew him. Mr. Morley's worked in Washington for 30 years, 15 of which were spent at the Washington Post. He has written about intelligence, military, and political subjects for The Intercept, Salon, The Atlantic, and others. His previous book, titled Our Man in Mexico, concerned Winston Scott, the CIA's station chief in Mexico City. This is a book which we highly recommend to you. But our subject volume today is the even more provocative, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Angleton. National Book Award winner Tim Weiner had this to say about it. The best book ever written about the strangest CIA chief who ever lived. No screenwriter or novelist could conjure a character like Angleton. But Morley's stellar reporting and superb writing animate every page of this work. It's essential history and highly entertaining biography. Given that I had a copy shipped to me the day it was available, I can happily second Mr. Weiner's view of it, and I'm delighted to be able to say welcome back to Radio Parallax, Jefferson Morley.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
James Angleton showed up in your book about Win Scott as a rather mysterious figure manipulating the flow of information going to and coming from Mexico City in 1963. Did that episode jumpstart an interest in writing about Mr. Angleton?
Yeah, it did. James Angleton and Win Scott were the same generation of the CIA. Guys who came into intelligence work via the Office of Strategic Services during World War II, became enthralled with intelligence work and joined the CIA when it opened in 1947, and then served in the CIA for 25 years. So the careers of these two men were intertwined, and indeed for a lot of that time, Angleton and Scott were friends. So I knew a lot about Angleton after I had finished the book. The thing that I didn't quite realize was how much more had come into the public record since I wrote Our Man in Mexico in the early 2000s. When I got the contract for the Angleton book in 2015, I realized there was this huge body of material about things that had really not been written about by Angleton's other biographers, specifically Angleton's role in the JFK assassination story, but other things as well. So by the time I got around to writing this book, there was lots of material that had not really been used by other authors. So there was lots of good stories to tell, and The Ghost is the result, a compilation of those good stories.
Well, back in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower became president. He appointed Alan Dulles as head of the CIA, who Angleton knew from his OSS days. Angleton convinces Dulles personally to give him some extraordinary access to materials as a head of counterintelligence. Can you outline what a remarkable niche Angleton carved out for himself, which you've kind of described as a CIA within the CIA?
In the early 1950s, Angleton was certainly a highly regarded officer, and he had good relationships with Alan Dulles, who he had known. But he was not by any means first among equals at the CIA. But in 1954, he had the idea that CIA operations were insecure, that the KGB was much more efficient at infiltrating the CIA and U.S. institutions than people had appreciated. And he said the CIA, what this agency needed was a counterintelligence staff to ferret out threats to internal CIA security. The CIA didn't have any centralized counterintelligence function. They had counterintelligence officers working on specific operations, but nobody overseeing the whole area of counterintelligence. So Angleton created this job, thought it up, and persuaded Dulles to do it. And so that became his platform for amassing a great deal of power. The counterintelligence staff was created in 1954. It had basically, in Angleton's original conception, about four offices within it. So it started as a relatively small operation. By 1958-59, the counterintelligence staff had 200 people working for it, all under Angleton's control. Half of those were officers and agents. Half of those were clerical people. But this was the heart of Angleton's operation, which he used from 54 to 74 to amass a great deal of power in all sorts of areas, like you said, that went far beyond counterintelligence. So he really used this job that he thought of to fill his own intelligence ambition.
It's been noted that we live in something of a surveillance state these days, the revelations about the NSA and other things. Back in the 50s, Angleton allied himself with J. Edgar Hoover to sort of forge a relationship between the CIA and FBI to basically spy on Americans. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is one of the interesting stories that was in the public record but had not been appreciated. In 1958, J. Edgar Hoover wanted to expand what he called the COINTELPRO program. And COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program which had been used by the FBI to attack, discredit perceived enemies of America. And the program had been created during World War II to take on pro-German organizations in the United States. Hoover revived this in the late 1950s to go after communists in the United States. And one thing that he wanted to do was he wanted to open up the mail of communists, but he was uncertain about how to go about doing this. So started making inquiries. And when he did, Angleton got wind of this. Angleton was the CIA's liaison to the FBI. And Angleton approached him and said, by the way, we're already opening people's mail. And that was a program that Angleton had created not long after he created the counterintelligence staff called Lingual. And Lingual was a program to open up all the foreign mail of selected people. So this was mail from the United States to overseas or from overseas into the United States. And Angleton created the capacity to open letters. Again, like the counterintelligence staff, grows very rapidly. When Angleton first gets control of the program in 55, they're opening 100 letters a year. Within 5 years, they're opening 10,000 letters a year. So Angleton took this thing to scale, as he so often did. And that became the basis for Hoover's expansion of the COINTELPRO program. Hoover was very concerned about this, and one of his aides said, you know, they thought all hell was going to break loose because, wow, the CIA was spying on Americans, and the CIA was poaching on FBI turf.
Right.
Well, Angleton cleverly put the thing together, and Hoover, always hungry for more secrets, welcomed Angleton's gift of intelligence. So Angleton created a program called Hunter, and what Hunter was fed all of the Lingual letters. Any letters that the FBI wanted were funneled to them. So the FBI could then levy their requirements on Angleton's intelligence collection. And so COINTELPRO grew in part because it was fed by Angleton's intelligence. COINTELPRO was always a joint program of those two agencies. It was not just a Hoover specialty. It was a Hoover-Angleton program. And so that's new. When we talk about COINTELPRO, we always talk about the FBI. And it's true that their focus was domestic intelligence agencies, but they were always fed with CIA intelligence as well. So you can't take Angleton out of the COINTELPRO picture.
Well, let's take another look at back at the 1950s. There's a very small subplot in the book, which is probably not worth spending a great deal of time on, but it really struck me. You mentioned how Angleton befriended Jay Lovestone, a former Communist Labor Party leader. He got money from the CIA and contacts, and soon he and Angleton pretty much control what U.S. labor unions have to say about American foreign policy, which surprises people how much influence they gain by infiltration.
Yes, and it's not a small subplot. It was a major part of Angleton's empire was that he could count on the support of the AFL-CIO's, you know, foreign policy unit, the AFL-CIO's relations with any other labor unions around the world. And so the AFL-CIO became the instrument of U.S. policy, completely unknown to its members. And this was driven by Angleton's close friendship with Jay Lovestone. When Jay Lovestone lived in New York, but he came to Washington frequently in the 1950s. And when he did, he would spend the night at Angleton's house. He was friends with Angleton's kids. He was very close to Angleton, and this ensured CIA influence over the AFL-CIO.
Well, in 1959, a young ex-Marine defects to the USSR. His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. Angleton's counterintelligence staff immediately gets involved in this matter. You note, and others have noted, that Oswald should have had a personnel file open on him as a defector. Instead, Angleton's Office of Security opens a rather more restricted file on him. And right up to the JFK assassination, Angleton was informed of Oswald's activity. This took you and others a great deal of effort to uncover, as this has been hidden for years, but it's quite a revelation.
Yeah. I think this is probably the biggest and most important thing in the ghost is the story of the surveillance of Oswald from 1959 to 1963. The JFK assassination story is contested in every area and all that, but the paper trail shows very clearly, this is not a theory or open to interpretation, is the CIA was definitely paying close attention to Lee Harvey Oswald, starting in October 1959 and continuing for the next 4 years. And when I say paying close attention to, we need to understand what this paper trail tells us, which is all information about this obscure young man, Lee Harvey Oswald, over the course of 4 years was funneled into one place, an office within the counterintelligence staff called the Special Investigations Group. So it wasn't, there was no failure to connect the dots on Oswald. All of the dots were in one place. They were in a file controlled by Angleton's staff. And over the course of 4 years, there was quite a bit of information in there, probably between 40 to 50 documents, FBI reports, CIA memoranda, CIA analysis, State Department, Office of Naval Intelligence, and newspaper clipping. And so wherever Oswald went in that time, the CIA was informed very quickly, where was he living? What was going on in his personal life? What was going on with his employment? What was going on with his politics? What was going on with his possible contacts with foreigners? So the story that the American people were told on November 23rd, that this guy named Oswald came out of nowhere and shot the president, that is fundamentally and irrefutably a lie. Oswald was not unknown to top CIA operations officers, including James Angleton. To the contrary, he was very well known. So that's quite apart from any interpretation of was there a conspiracy or not. That's a fact that is very well established in the ghost. And I'm glad to say that it's not being disputed by the people who read it because the paper trail is so strong, is so clear that that was the case.
Well, I have to at this point insert my single favorite quote from the ghost, which was, "If Oswald was a lone nut, as cliche would have it, he was the rare, isolated sociopath of interest to the CIA's counterintelligence staff."
Absolutely, absolutely. This story that this guy came out of nowhere, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, it didn't make any sense to people at the time because people thought, well, he defected to the Soviet Union. Wouldn't the CIA be interested in that? And so the CIA sort of played dumb, and they got a pass from the press corps on this. Oh, yeah, he defected, but we didn't really know anything about him. No, that is completely and absolutely false.
Yeah.
And anybody who looks at the record now knows it. You know, you can say what you want about the assassination after that, but what I'm saying about the surveillance of Oswald is a fact.
Well, let's delve into that a little bit. In fall of 63, Oswald apparently goes to Mexico City, and the chief of station there, Winscott, the subject of your previous biography, reports on the visit and requests the latest info on Oswald. Angleton's office deliberately sends misleading data back to Scott. Does that not raise questions of whether Angleton was actually manipulating Oswald's activities?
Yeah, well, you know, it's very curious that the top official in the CIA would be sending a cable about a future presidential assassin that was completely erroneous and contradicted by information that he had in his office at the time. So I don't have a good explanation of why he was doing that. Angleton operated at very devious levels, and I didn't want to speculate about it. But yeah, you know, Oswald shows up in Mexico City. He talks to the Cubans. He talks to the Soviets. Angleton knows that all the diplomatic officials in those in those offices are presumed to be intelligence officers, and indeed most of them were. He knows that Oswald was arrested in New Orleans for fighting with a CIA-funded Cubans. In the FBI reports, the FBI said that he beat his wife. So when Angleton gets notified that Oswald's in Mexico City, he could have turned around and told Wynn Scott, look, this guy is an open leftist. He's working for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which had been listed as a subversive organization by the Justice Department. He beats his wife. He's gotten arrested. Now he showed up in Mexico City, and he's making contact with presumed Cuban and Russian intelligence agencies. And, you know, therefore, like, if you hear more about him, tell me about that or whatever. He could have sent a very strong message. And instead, he sends a message saying, don't worry about this guy. His time in the Soviet Union had a maturing effect on him. And so Wynn Scott believes this, right? He has no reason to think that headquarters is deceiving him. So he says, you know, he makes various other requests. He's trying to find out more information about Oswald. Angleton didn't tell Wynn Scott. He could have turned around and told the FBI in Dallas and New Orleans. And one other thing that I point out in The Ghost, which is new and was not previously known, was Angleton received an FBI report in November 1963 saying that Oswald had returned from Mexico City and had gone to Dallas. So Angleton knew that Oswald was in Dallas a week before the assassination. That's pretty clear from the paper trail that we now have. That's another thing that is unexplained about his response to Lee Harvey Oswald. But what we know for sure is he had plenty of information of sort of warning signs about Oswald, and he did not share them with anybody. To the contrary, he shared false information or erroneous information with his own colleagues about Oswald. So that's very clear that he did that. Now, the question is, was he doing that to conceal an operation? You know, and I think that's possible. That could be. You know, if there's some circumstantial evidence. I didn't write that because I'm not sure of that, you know, and we don't know. But we do know that Angleton was watching Oswald very carefully for 4 years before JFK was killed.
Well, I need to point out to our listeners, Mr. Morley, that you have a great reputation for getting the story and telling it cleanly, and people respect your disinclination to speculate past what can be established. But I'd like you to allow me to speculate on what you've uncovered about Angleton's interest in Oswald. It has always struck people as preposterous that Oswald could defect, tell the embassy he's going to give military secrets to the Soviets, and then not be prosecuted upon his return to the U.S. Is it not most reasonable to assume that the accused assassin was a U.S. government agent on some level, rather than the Marxist, mixed-up, murderous individual known to history?
That's a very plausible conclusion to be drawn. You can do that. I mean, we don't have proof of that.
Right.
I would say the evidence is lacking. Just as I would say, the evidence does not support the mix-up Marxist little man who wanted to kill a big man. It doesn't support that impression either. That's not a very good description of who Oswald was or what his mentality or his politics were. I think one of the most interesting things that I learned in doing the book was, you know, Oswald was very pro-civil rights. And was very unusual for a, you know, uneducated, I mean, not a college-educated, white working-class man from the South. And Oswald had a spontaneous sympathy for civil rights and for blacks, and which he acted on. You know, when he was arrested in New Orleans, the New Orleans courtroom was still legally segregated. And Oswald showed up for his trial. He went and sat with the black people. As a way of expressing sympathy and saying legal segregation was BS. He told George Des Moines Schilt that the one he thought Kennedy was kind of an ordinary politician, would say anything to get elected, but the one thing that he liked about Kennedy was that he was pro-civil rights. This idea that he would then turn around and go kill a pro-civil rights president because he's a leftist, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So my view is we don't have a very good explanation of the assassination. And what you're talking about was Oswald being used in U.S. intelligence operations. That's a very plausible alternative. And so when we don't have a good explanation, I think we got to look at all the alternatives.
We're speaking with author and investigative journalist Jefferson Morley about his fascinating new biography, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. Well, In 1962, Angleton got involved in matters related to Cuba, which the government was obsessed with. He developed a plan to remove Castro. It was less dramatic than the one the Joint Chiefs endorsed, which is called Operation Northwoods. Can you talk just a little bit about that plan? Because I think people tend to doubt that such a thing could have ever really been proposed.
This is another thing that I think is new in the Angleton biography. The extent to which Angleton was involved in Cuba policy during the Kennedy years, Angleton is always associated in popular accounts with his own hunt for a mole within the CIA, and more largely with the CIA's struggles with the KGB. Cuba has not really figured as part of Angleton's career, at least in the way it's been, you know, recorded by history. And the ghost shows that Angleton was deeply involved in Cuba policy, first in being tasked with creating a intelligence service that would become the intelligence service of the U.S. of the pro-U.S. government that was expected to replace Castro when Castro was overthrown. A second thing that Angleton did was he was involved in plans to assassinate Castro, and he talked about these plans with Peter Wright and Bill Harvey. And so, you know, he was involved in Cuba policy at that level. And then in 1962 and 63, the Pentagon was proposing a little bit different solution to the Cuba problem. President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy did not want a full-blown invasion of Cuba. They had resisted that during the Bay of Pigs, and they resisted it during the missile crisis. The Pentagon did, and they said that the policy that Kennedy preferred, to have the Cubans instigate a rebellion against Castro on their own, was never going to work, and that the U.S. should create a pretext to invade Cuba. And so they came up with the plans that you mentioned, Operation Northwoods. And Northwoods was plans developed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff Planning Division. So this happened at the highest level of the Pentagon. And the challenge was, how could they create a situation in which the U.S. would be justified in invading Cuba with U.S. armed forces, as opposed to relying on Cubans to overthrow Castro. And the solution, according to the Northwoods planners, was to create a pretext, what they called an engineered provocation. And this was what is sometimes called a false flag operation in intelligence lingo. And the idea was, create a spectacular international incident in which the U.S. was the victim of some kind of attack or terrorism that the U.S. could then claim was a justification for the invasion of Cuba. And the Northwoods planners came up with at least a dozen different scenarios: a terror attack in Washington or Miami, a hijacking of an airplane, if the early NASA mission, John Glenn, one of the first men in space, If his spacecraft had crashed, they were going to say that the Cubans had interfered with communications and had brought the spaceship down, and that would be a justification for war. I mean, they were really thinking hard about how to do this. And so this was the preferred option, and this wasn't somebody, you know, musing in their desk or talking at a bar. This was a set of policy proposals that were requested and approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962 and in 1963. And what I add to that story, which has been known since 1997 when the Northwoods papers were declassified, what I can add to that story is Angleton was brought into Cuba policy shortly after that with the mission of assessing the Cuban target. And so he wrote a paper called Cuban Capabilities, which was circulated to the Joint Chiefs of Staff right after they approved of the Northwoods plan. And this was a very lucid, comprehensive study of just how Castro's security forces worked. And so Angleton was deeply involved in this. Now, you know, was there a connection between Angleton's involvement and the Northwoods plan? We don't know that, but Angleton was very involved in Cuba policy in mid-1963, and that involvement is important because in that memo, Angleton talks about, you know, how the Cubans launch their intelligence operations, how they acquire support, how they do propaganda and all that. And in the memo, he talks about the Cuban consulate in Mexico City as this key place for Cuban intelligence to operate from. So this is May 1963. Jim Angleton is thinking very closely about a very specific location, the Cuban consulate in Mexico City. And less than 5 months later, Lee Harvey Oswald, the man who he's been watching since 1959, walks into that consulate. And, of course, Angleton's office is immediately notified. So when Lee Harvey Oswald arrived at the Cuban consulate in 1963 for purposes that remain obscure, and we can talk about that whole incident, but when he arrived there, Jim Angleton was not clueless. He was not surprised. He was not baffled. He was very well prepared. He knew who Oswald was, and he knew why the Cuban consulate was important. And then 6 weeks later, President Kennedy was dead, allegedly killed by Lee Harvey Oswald. So that set of events, which is very enigmatic, it's very puzzling, is very clear. I mean, factually, that's all true. We go through these permutations trying, well, what could explain this? And that's when we develop theories to explain a very strange set of facts. But the facts are there. Yeah. Now we need to figure out what's the best explanation of those facts.
Well, I have to ask you about something that that I found very puzzling in The Ghost and kind of whapped upside the head by it, was the revelation that after this visit to Mexico City by Oswald, Angleton launches a mole hunt down there looking for people with allegiance to other agencies. It's a very, to me, a very strange episode. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it is a very strange episode because what I describe in The Ghost is a mole hunt. FBI had a source that was feeding them information. And Angleton thought that this source might be a double agent, that he was feeding them bad information. So what he did was he wanted to know if anybody in the Mexico City station had contact with a foreign intelligence service or a police force. And so they sent a group of interrogators to Mexico City, and they interviewed about 20 Mexican employees of the Mexico City station. And this is literally within a week of Oswald's visit to the Cuban consulate and the Soviet embassy. These people go down there and they're looking for, is anybody talking to the KGB? And the first three guys who they interview, the very first three guys, are the guys who man the surveillance outposts on the Cuban consulate and the Soviet embassy, the places that Oswald had visited 10 days before. Now, was that particular mole hunt connected to Oswald's visit? I mean, again, we don't have any proof of that, but the timing, the coincidence of the timing is at least noteworthy. And it shows you how much Angleton was interested in the Cuban consulate and the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. This was not something that was off of his mind. This was something that he cared very deeply about and was worried about the possibility of communist penetration. So then, when 6 weeks later, an alleged communist is arrested for allegedly killing the president, having passed through the place that there were great, you know, counterintelligence concerns about, again, you got to wonder, what's going on? What explains that? I mean, you know, it could be a total coincidence, and somebody could come along and say, look, there was no connection at all. Well, it would be interesting if somebody had recorded that in a memo after the assassination or something. We don't have anything like that. So we're still left to wonder, was there a connection between Oswald's visit in Mexico City and Angleton's mole hunt, which immediately followed afterwards? And I got to say, again, it's possible that there's a connection.
I'm Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. Let's take a short break.